July 1st dawned bright and sunny in the little town of Abbeville. Larks were whistling and chirping above the square, making endless circles in the sky. There was scarcely a cloud to be seen. But already an ugly animal was moving through the tiny, curving little streets. The animal had many parts, and each part was a man or a woman. Some had been awake even before dawn, coming from farms far off. They were silent. There was no joking and hardly any conversation. And as they all converged on the square and became the one big animal, Sigismundo, leaning out the inn window in his nightshirt, knew at once this was no Saint's Day or any local carnival. "Papa," he said, "come see." Guido Cellini, also in his nightshirt, stumbled wearily to the window and looked. The animal was getting bigger and uglier every minute.
"Jesus," Guido said.
"What do you think it is?" Sigismundo asked.
"I don't know," Papa said, "but I wish to all the saints that our coach was leaving right now."
The coach was not due to leave until about noon, so that the passengers could sleep late. Looking into the distance, Sigismundo could see the foothills of the Alps. "This surely is a beautiful place to live," he thought. "I wonder why that mob has such an ugly mood about it."
"Wash quickly," Papa said, "and get into your clothes. I think it would be a good idea to take a walk far away from the town square."
Sigismundo was already moving to obey.
He remembered the festivities after old Umberto was burned. A mob of moralists gets excited by violence, and after a while, anything can happen. He and Papa could be set upon and beaten, or worse, just because they were not locals.
One lovely lark, separated from the flock, sailed past the window, gliding easily and slowly. Far off, a rooster crowed.
"That is a fact I will remember," Sigismundo thought, "when something god-awful is happening. Most of nature doesn't even notice. It just goes about its own business."
But when he and Papa were dressed and descended to the ground floor of the inn, they found that the angry animal was now even bigger. People were jammed together like fish in a net right up to the door of the inn. Opening the door to step outside, he and Papa would be engulfed in the press of bodies.
"Well," Papa said simply, "it is, after all, none of our affair. We will have breakfast."
They found their way to the dining room and discovered the other passenger from the coach, a fat Bavarian named Hans Zeusser, who was already eating.
"Sit down," Zeusser said cordially. "It is not, hospitable outside."
They took a seat with a blonde Bavarian who, they had learned on the coach, was a lawyer.
"What is happening?" Guido asked cautiously.
"An auto da fe," Zeusser said coolly. "The southern French still have these nostalgic medieval rituals occasionally." He broke off a piece of croissant and chewed it.
"The guest of honor," he added, munching, "is a young nobleman named Labarre."
"They are going to burn him?" Guido asked, barely concealing his revulsion.
"God in heaven, no," Zeusser said, still munching. "They are too civilized for that in France these days. They are merely going to chop his head off. Much more humane, hein?"
"What did this Labarre do?" Guido asked.
"A terrible, terrible thing," Zeusser said, scraping some egg off his plate. "It takes a great deal to bring the death penalty down on a nobleman, you know. If it were one of the ordinary peccadilloes of the rich, if he had been sodomizing peasant children for sport, say, or poisoning his wife, he would probably have gotten off with a sentence of exile. He is a chevalier, and you know what that means.
It means he was related, however distantly, to the royal family," Sigismundo knew.
"No, this was a serious offense," Zeusser said. "No family connections could help him in a case like this."
"Well, for God's sake, what was it?" Guido asked, growing impatient with the lawyer's irony.
Zeusser munched some more croissant and washed it down with that devilish new drink the French were so fond of, coffee.
"The chevalier Jean-François Lefebvre de la Barre," he said with a poker face, "was found to have a book by Voltaire in his house."
Sigismundo could scarcely believe it, but the lawyer, despite his penchant for florid sarcasm, was obviously not joking about the facts. His face was sober and had the expression of a doctor who has decided this case is hopeless and he had better forget it and move on to the next one. Sigismundo lost all caution.
But that is absurd, he exclaimed. In Paris, everybody regards Voltaire as old-fashioned and reads books much more radical than his.
Zoiser nodded. But that is Paris. This is the country. The church does not have so many rich and powerful enemies here. These are pure, simple, uncorrupted workers of the soil. Noble savages, Rousseau would say. And so, in their simple, pure, uncorrupted savagery, they are eager to see this man's head cut off, because their priests say he is evil. Faith may not have the power to remove mountains, as we are told, but it certainly can remove common sense and common decency. The innkeeper arrived. He looked as if he hadn't changed his shirt since the days of Louis XIV, and had an expression that might make a cattle stampede swerve in the other direction. He set down croissants and eggs for Guido and Sigismundo and trudged off sullenly, obviously not liking what he had heard of Zoiser's remarks. He suspects us of secular humanism, Sigismundo thought. Somebody informed on this Labarre, Papa said thoughtfully. Even the Dominicans wouldn't just crash in on a chevalier and start ransacking his library without some provocation.
You haven't heard of the terrorists? Zoiser asked.
Sigismundo and Guido at once thought of the Rossi, but Zoiser went on. There is a group, or a lone lunatic, nobody knows, going about doing, well, perfectly obscene things to churches. After all, and at this point even Zoiser lowered his voice, the church owns almost all the land. If you walk north, east, south, or west from here, for weeks on end, you will never see anything gaudy but a cathedral and nobody fat but a priest. If there is going to be resentment, the church is going to be the target.
Labarre is suspected of being the vandal who attacked the churches? Guido asked.
From what I've heard, Zoiser said, dozens of suspects were arrested. Labarre finally got elected because of the book by Voltaire in his house.
My God, Guido said, even in Napoli. He checked himself.
Yes, Zoiser said, this is extreme, even for the Holy Office. And I sit here and stuff myself with pastry and make bad jokes because, gentlemen, there is not a damn thing strangers like us can do about it. Do you want to go out and lecture on the laws of evidence to that mob?
Sigismundo pushed aside his eggs. He took a sip of coffee, unable to digest anything solid.
What were those desecrations that Labarre is being blamed for?
You don't want to hear it at breakfast, Zoiser said.
I can't eat anyway, Sigismundo said. I'm not hungry either, Papa added.
You'll be sorry later, Zoiser said. We have a long ride ahead today. You must learn to grow a certain amount of callus around your feelings.
Just then the tumult finally came. The young chevalier was being led through the mob by the jailer. Separate voices began to reach the dining room, more shrill than the surrounding roar.
Pig! Atheist scoundrel! Filthy dog!
Gradually, the roar and the shrieking subsided into a tense silence. The executioner was making his preparations.
What did the vandal do to the churches? Sigismundo asked, trying to keep conversation going, to avoid listening for the sound of the axe.
Well, since you're not eating anyway, Zoiser said, he, or they, since it might have been a group, threw human excrement all over the crucifix and the altar.
Mother of God, Guido said hollowly.
You might say that both religious and anti-religious feelings are running high in this country these days, Zoiser said, sipping coffee with a hand that shook slightly. Suddenly, the inn door opened. A Dominican stood there.
Everybody out, he said in a tone that precluded argument.
Papa Guido argued anyway.
We are just passing through, he said. This isn't our country.
The innkeeper glared at all three of them.
This is a public execution, said the Dominican, a jowly but muscular man with eyes that most of them had, eyes that suspected literally everybody of virtually everything. Its purpose is to demonstrate justice. It is to be seen by all, as a lesson to all. Are you atheists? Shall I call the bailiff?
We're coming, Zoiser said smoothly. We were just finishing breakfast, your reverence. As they arose, Papa Guido whispered,
You don't have to look. Keep your eyes on something neutral in the distance. The Chevalier, Jean-François Lefabre de la Barre, was a young dandy of about 25, Sigismundo guessed, and looked surprisingly robust in view of the fact that he must have been held in a dungeon for many months between the arrest and the execution. He was dressed in a penitent's robes, as prescribed for heretics, but looked as if he were still in his best brocade. It is the disdainful way he stands, Sigismundo thought. He still is a chevalier, and they are trained for war. Only in rare periods of peace do they live into middle age. He has been preparing for death all his life, in a sense. A Dominican on the execution platform finished a prayer. The jailer whispered something to Labarre. The chevalier knelt obediently, without any last words, without any visible emotion, and coolly placed his head in the cavity of the executioner's block. He is making his speech through his behavior, Sigismundo thought. He is showing them how a brave man dies. Look away, Papa repeated urgently. But Sigismundo could not avert his gaze. I wouldn't look when they burned Umberto, he thought, but this time I will not be a coward. This is my possible future being enacted up there. I am a heretic myself. I must look death straight in the eye and know the true face of the church that may kill me some day. The executioner raised his axe. The whole crowd seemed to hold its breath. The scatological Cockney refrain ran through Sigismundo's head. Who shit in the church? Labarre shit. Bullshit. Who shit? The axe descended. The head fell into the basket. An unbelievable geyser of blood sprayed out of the neck, 10 times worse than Uncle Leonardo's wounds in the church. A fountain. Almost a flood. We will be drowned in it, Sigismundo thought, almost starting to vomit, clenching his teeth, holding it down, misquoting Shakespeare to himself. Who would have thought the young man had so much blood in him? He clenched his teeth again and did not vomit. The crowd was cheering wildly, and all the church bells began to chime. Kill, 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 and kill, they seemed to say to Sigismundo. I am the god of the iron rod, and this is my will. Kill. Kill, kill, and kill. This is my future, Sigismundo thought. No, my possible future. I will be too smart for them. I will go back to England. I will never set foot in a Catholic country again. I think I'm going to vomit after all. You can't blame it all on the Dominicans. Our whole religion is a blend of the sublime and the bestial, like our politics. Lord, I mustn't get hysterical and start thinking about chickens in the Vatican again. And then the executioner, following tradition, held the head aloft for all to see, and Sigismundo almost felt he was full of belladonna again, because the chevalier's eyes were still conscious and full of pain. Of course, he had heard about that. Life remains in the brain for a few moments, and the eyes show awareness. But if the mouth opens and he talks, I will finally go mad. I didn't know it was going to be this bad, the eyes of Labarre seemed to say. But then the eyes ceased to focus, and death was complete. Glittering diamonds stared out of a dead face. Labarre had been brave and true, Sigismundo thought, but it didn't really make any difference. His death was as ugly as the death of a coward. It was foul, 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 and the mob rejoiced. Sigismundo was suddenly aware that in the effort to avoid vomiting, he had clenched his teeth until his jaw hurt. Nobody noticed as Papa quietly edged Sigismundo back into the inn. Herr Zeusser followed unobtrusively. Wine, the Bavarian cried as soon as they were seated. The innkeeper set the bottle on their table. That is how we treat monsters here, he said grimly, as if all foreigners were probably monsters too. Sigismundo and Guido drank along with a lawyer. To the Holy Roman Catholic and Apostolic Church, Zeusser said. To the civilizer of Europe, he raised his glass in a toast. Lutherans have done terrible things too, Sigismundo reminded himself. They once forced children to watch as their mothers were burned for witchcraft. It is not one church or one sect. It is anybody anywhere who becomes fanatic. Jesus, Papa said softly, I'll never forget this day. I don't hate the whole church, Sigismundo was telling himself. I don't. It's only the Inquisition. I must not become a fanatic myself. But it was not true. At that moment, if he could have destroyed the church with one blow, demolishing every building, every altar, every nave and ciborium, he knew he would strike that blow. His first week home, it seemed as if Napoli had changed completely. That was an illusion, of course. It was he, Sigismundo, who had changed. But everything that people did and said was no longer natural and taken for granted. It was distinctly, peculiarly Neapolitan. He had always thought tourists were rather rude. They seemed to stare in the most impolite manner as they scuttled about Napoli. Now he understood them. They were staring because half or more of what they saw was alien and incomprehensible, as half or more of what he had seen in Spain, England, and France was shocking to him at first sight. It was as Vico said, people made up a world by talking to each other, and then they lived in the world they had talked into existence. When Sigismundo met Antonio again, he was startled and distressed. Tony was waxy pale again and had that strange smell. Have you been to see Dr. Orfali lately? Sigismundo asked, knowing Tony's illness had come back because of his mother's death. That sodomite? Tony asked angrily. We shouldn't associate with sodomites. They want to seduce all of us. Sigismundo tried to be reasonable. Dr. Orfali is not a sodomite, he said. You are letting your imagination run away with you. I can recognize sodomites no matter how they try to hide, Tony said, calm and certain. They caused the fall of the Roman Empire. They are everywhere, and they are always plotting. There was a great deal more of that, and gradually the horrible truth came home to Sigismundo. The last time, he thought, Tony knew he was ill and wanted to be cured. This time he does not even suspect that he is ill. Sigismundo went straight to Malatesta and Celline wine exports and found Uncle Pietro. Tony is ill again, he said. I know, Uncle Pietro said wearily. He won't go to Dr. Orfali. He doesn't want to go, Pietro said. I've been dragging him there once a week anyway, but it is much harder this time. He is full of hostility. He suspects Dr. Orfali of being a sodomite. It is worse than that, Uncle Pietro said gravely. He suspects everybody of being a sodomite. He has an infallible method, he says, of detecting sodomy, no matter how well it is hidden. Sigismundo sighed. What can be done? I don't know, Uncle Pietro said. There is nobody in Napoli who understands these things as well as Abraham. And even if I found such a person, Tony would just decide that person was a sodomite too. So I take him to Abraham, and Abraham tries to help him, but this is a different illness. Yes, Sigismundo said. This one, in some sense, he enjoys. Pietro shook his head. He doesn't really enjoy it, he said. It is just preferable to the other choices he can imagine at this point. After all, it is not as frightening as hearing demon voices and not being able to concentrate on anything but noses. It makes him feel important, too. He thinks eventually all fair-minded people will agree he is right and join him in a crusade to drive all the sodomites out of Napoli. Don't, for Jesus' sake, argue with him. He will go on for hours producing evidence to support his delusion. It is what the French call an idée fixe. It is an idée fixe, to an exponential power. I have seen it a few times before. I once knew a man who was a brilliant natural philosopher, and then he began seeing Masonic symbols on the moon. The more other astronomers tried to reason with him, the more he became convinced they were all part of a conspiracy. That is the way it happens with this illness. The sufferer seems to enjoy it, as you thought, because he is continually involved in exciting quarrels and continually hoping he will be proved right. Actually, his anger is growing all the time until it blinds him, and he is getting lonelier and lonelier. We can only hope and do our best. Sometimes there is a remission. And so the matter rested for a while. Sigismundo met Antonio on the street one day and received a venomous glance. He has proved I am a sodomite, Sigismundo thought. His infallible method has detected it in my walk or my music or something. The sun had set. The bay waters were the glittering purple of good Burgundy, and Sigismundo was working on a new sonata he called The Two Nations. He hadn't seen any Rossi since his return. Dead men had not come to the door with black magic grimoires, and he was thoroughly absorbed in the music. He had been working lately on a new exercise Abraham had given him, to look each day for 10 beautiful things in Napoli he had never noticed before. It reminds you that the things you worry about do not comprise all of existence, Abraham said. Sigismundo heard the raised voices in the living room before he realized what they were saying. In the bay. 10 minutes ago. Divers are still jumping. He was irritated at being interrupted in a beautiful semi-fugue structure, and then, of course, he was immediately ashamed of that selfish attitude. He raced downstairs. Papa was already on his way out the door. Sigismundo caught up with him at the street gate. Is it Antonio? He asked, but he knew. Yes, God help him. I can run faster. Which part of the bay? Down by the Piazza Reale. Sigismundo was already racing downhill. Down, 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 he thought, like the day I was going to kill little Carlo, and I thought of the Bulgia of the suicides that day. Dante has turned them into trees. He could see the Teatro San Carlo, the best thing Don Carlos ever did for Napoli, and now he's trying to abolish bullfights in Spain. Everything is connected. He was panting, but the bay was closer. I know why Tony did it, he thought. He had finally proved that everybody in Napoli was a sodomite. He was all alone then, surrounded by perverts who lusted for him. That's the way this illness works. You lock yourself in a cage of suspicion and then grow more terrified because you are now alone, because he couldn't accept the deaths of his father and mother and needed an explanation for what was wrong with the world, because the only explanation that made sense to him in that state was one that allowed him to hate everybody. As soon as Sigismundo crossed the Piazza Reale, he knew where Antonio had jumped. There was a crowd gathered by the pier on Via Ammiragliato. Sigismundo stopped to catch his breath. I never even liked him, he thought, but that does not matter. He is a malatesta. I have my duty. There were several boys and young men in their undergarments dripping. They had been diving for several minutes. With a shock, Sigismundo saw Carlo Maldonado come to the surface and breathe deeply. Then, in 30 seconds, Carlo dived again. The boy I almost killed, trying to save my crazy cousin. Sigismundo tore off his boots and outer clothing. It's probably pointless now, he thought, but I've got to try. Suicide is the worst sin, the sin against the Holy Spirit. That is why even strangers are diving. Several people looked at him evasively out of the corners of their eyes. They knew it was probably too late. Christ, he thought, the church won't even let us bury him in sanctified ground. Not when half the city knows he jumped. Sigismundo dived. The water was colder than he expected, almost frigid. It's after sunset now, he told himself. It always gets colder when the sun goes down. But he was thinking of his nightmare vision of drowning in icy water while he was crossing the English Channel. I won't drown. I'm a good swimmer. Carlo Maldonado was swimming near him. Then, his eyes adjusting to the darkness, he saw a fish of a species he had never encountered before. God knows what's down at the bottom of the bay that I've never seen, he thought. Sigismundo came back to the surface and breathed. He realized that he was much farther out than he had thought. The tide was ebbing, the current was outward. Antonio could be a long way gone by now. Another head came to the surface, further out still. It was getting darker, but Sigismundo thought he recognized one of the Portinari boys. Sigismundo swam north and west for a while. That was the direction of the current, which would be carrying Tony. He dived again and almost collided with an octopus. A tentacle touched him, but then it moved away rapidly in a purple spray. Sigismundo swam back from the inky excretion. Fish, fish, fish. No human bodies anywhere, not even other divers. When he came to the surface again, he could hardly see the pier. It was getting darker rapidly, and there was less visibility below the water also. "What can I do?" he asked out loud, almost hoping God would answer. "Keep diving. Don't give up. He may be alive." Sigismundo swam further north. He noticed that his teeth were beginning to chatter. Peppino was more than human because he would not admit limits. "What I must do is be like that. Do not admit any limits, anywhere." He dived again. He was lost in inky blackness, and for a moment he thought he had collided with another octopus. No, it was just the absence of the sun. He came up. "What can I do?" he asked again. Then he saw the torches coming, golden flames in the twilight. Some of the fishermen had put out in their boats to assist the divers. He dived again. Inky blackness, but his eyes were getting accustomed to it. Down, 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 and nothing but fish. He came up. "Over here," he shouted, and before the fishermen arrived, he dived again. Down, 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 and no sign of Tony. A boat arrived as he came up again. Friendly, anxious faces. Sigismundo clutched the side of the boat, panting, listening to his teeth chatter. "You'd better come out," the pilot said. "You're turning blue." Sigismundo shook his head, too exhausted to reply. "It's the boy's cousin," somebody said. "Well, take some of this," the pilot said, holding a bottle to Sigismundo's lips. Sigismundo drank briefly. Too much would not help at all. It tasted like Malatesta and Celine Muscatel. If only his teeth would stop chattering. "You've wrestled with a professional assassin. You've been drugged and terrorized by Satanists. There's a gang of maniacs out there determined to coerce and cajole you into becoming their leader. You saw your father tortured to death, your uncle murdered, your aunt dead of grief. Now it's time to show some real courage. Dive down into that ice-cold water again." He dived. He could make out more in the reflected light of the torches, but all he saw were fish and more fish. The divers were far apart now, trying to cover the whole bay. Later, he never knew how many times he had dived, how many times the boat had found him again, how many times the pilot had begged him to stop. He remembered plunging again and again into the inky caverns, with only the torches shedding faint visibility. He remembered clinging time after time to the side of the boat, panting, teeth chattering, his body shaking with spasms of cold and exhaustion. He remembered diving again and again, as if the sea was a living, devouring god. He was driven now by fury, by outrage at the sheer unmitigated stupidity and cruelty of Antonio's act. "I don't care how crazy he was," he thought bitterly. "He had no right to do this to the family. We've been through enough and more than enough." He was freezing. He was, possibly, drowning. He was lost in cold and in pain. His fury drove him on. "Do not admit limits. I will find the bastard and tell him to his face, you had no right to do this." Down and down and down. "This night will curse us all," Uncle Pietro had said. He was clinging to the side of the boat again. It wasn't the same boat. He was completely lost now. "Come out, you're purple, you'll catch pneumonia." He dived again. "I'll find him, I'll bring him home. We can at least have a funeral." Down, 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 into the freezing inky blackness. Gold flames making strange patches of illumination. A dolphin went by suddenly, big as any crocodile, and Sigismundo was glad dolphins are not hostile to man. Back to the surface, hanging over the rail of a boat. Hands were pulling him up, a blanket was thrown around him. "No," he said, "I must go back down." "Shut up, drink this." Wine was poured into his lips. A cheap Chianti this time. He became aware that his whole body was jerking with spasms. Cold and exhaustion. But it was like the belladonna, the same internal explosion of the vegetative system. "I have failed again," he said, teeth chattering. "I stopped diving a half hour ago," said a voice. Sigismundo looked across the narrow boat.
Even in the dark, he recognized Carlo Maldonado.
"Everybody stopped a half hour ago," Carlo said. "I don't know what kept you going."
"Fury," Sigismundo thought. "When you have nothing else left, that will keep you going. It comes from my father's side of the family, with a little madness thrown in."
"Drink some more of this," a fisherman said, passing the Chianti again. "Do not feel ashamed. You lasted longer than the professional divers."
"He was my cousin," Sigismundo said numbly.
"Che mala fortuna," the fisherman said sympathetically.
"He should go to England," Sigismundo thought bitterly. "He has a talent for understatement." They rode in silence for a while, and Sigismundo stared morosely at the lights of Napoli coming closer.
"Carlo," he said finally.
"Yes?"
"This feud between our families. My uncle Pietro says it is a great folly.
My father says the same."
"You were very brave today. I will see that my whole family hears about what you did."
"I had to do it," Carlo said. "I felt so sorry for him. He looked so sad when he jumped."
They didn't say any more. They were both numb with exhaustion. The lights of the city came closer.
Part 6. The Hanged Man. I will not cease from mental fight, nor shall the sword sleep in my hand, till we have built Jerusalem in England's green and pleasant land. William Blake, Milton. John Babcock was born in 1745 in Dublin, Ireland, where his father, Sir Edward Babcock, was serving as a judge, but the ancestral home of the Babcocks was in Lowsworthshire, and the family returned there by the time the boy was 6 years old. "I shall never go back to Ireland again, not for the king, not for my country, not even for God," father often said. He had found in 7 years that not one Irishman existed who did not loathe the English. Sassenach, they called them, which was Gaelic for Saxons. Father, though a Whig, began to advocate Irish independence, not on humanitarian grounds, such as were urged by other Whigs, but simply on the grounds that the English would never be able to govern that country. Even Cromwell, who had acted like Attila the Hun when he invaded Ireland, had not destroyed the Irish rebellious spirit. The Irish had just become more fanatic and more secretive. Even the Battle of Boyne River, which crushed the Jacobites in Ireland, did not crush Irish intransigence. They just became more fanatical and founded more secret societies, or so father said. The boy did not remember much about the Dublin years. He knew, the way small children know such things, that father and mother both feared and respected the Irish, but that the fear was stronger than the respect. He was never left alone, not for a minute, since some of the Irish were capable of atrocities against English children. In later years, he remembered the beautiful leafy acres of Phoenix Park, the looming hulk of the Hill of Howth, where the castle door was always open at dinner time because of some inscrutable Irish superstition, and the dark-hued river Anna Liffey, sparkling and dancing as she came pouring down from the green hills. And he remembered that it was not safe to go beyond the pale, beyond the small area surrounding English Protestant Dublin, the area controlled by English troops. Beyond the pale, out there in the wild lands, where only Catholics and Jacobites and the monstrous white boys, who rode by night in white hoods and were capable of any cruelty against the English. And he remembered the field of Clontarf, where father had taken him in the interest of history, to see the spot where the aged Irish king, Brian Boru, had defeated the Vikings on April 23, 1014. Little Johnny thought it was an odd coincidence. April 23rd was Shakespeare's birthday, so he never forgot that date. But most of all, he remembered one grave father had taken him to, the grave of a man father said was the greatest writer of the century.
It would be a great waste if you grew up in Dublin and never saw this, Father said, and John was properly impressed. Father was quite gray already at 40 and wore his beard full and long. John often imagined that God looked a great deal like Father and had the same strict standards of honor. The gravestone was in St. Patrick's Cathedral, which was Anglican and not a den of papist idolatry at all. Let's see how your Latin is progressing, Father said. Can you translate it? And little Johnny, he was 5 at the time, translated, a bit haltingly. He has, gone when fierce indignation can no longer lacerate his heart. Yes, I have it. He has gone where fierce indignation can no longer lacerate his heart. Go, traveler, imitate him if you can. He served liberty. Jonathan Swift, 1667 to 1745. He died the year I was born, he thought. Damn fine epigraph, Father said. Hope they can say as much about me when my time comes. What did Mr. Swift do? Johnny said timidly. He raised merry hell, Father said. He was dean of the cathedral here by profession, but by avocation he was the greatest enemy of tyranny and humbug the world has ever produced. Young lawyer named Burke comes here regularly and stares at that tombstone. I'll wager a lot of others come here too, as I do on bad days. Remember this, Johnny lad. Try to live so that words like that might be appropriate to your stone at the end of your days. But what did Mr. Swift do? Johnny repeated. Was he in Parliament? He was more dangerous than any politician, Father said. He wrote books. A book can be the most deadly weapon in the world if it can get past the censors. He was so clever that nobody realized how subversive his books were until they were in circulation a long time, Father smiled. Some people still complain about his crude words and coarse language, as they do about Shakespeare. But he got his message across. He served intellectual liberty, you see, not just political liberty. Johnny knew what liberty meant. It was what Father and all the Whigs lived for, adored, worshipped. He served liberty. Any Whig would want that on his tombstone. But he did not understand those words about the lacerated heart, not at the age of 5. Father's real hero, though, was Lord Edward Coke, who had also served in Ireland, although a long time ago. In fact, Lord Coke had not so much served there as he had been exiled there. Edward Coke had been Lord Chief Justice under James I, and had tried to make James understand that there were some things even a king could not do, because the Constitution forbade them. But nobody could tell James I what he could not do, not even the Lord Chief Justice. James sent Coke off to serve in a minor bureaucratic post in Ireland. And the result of that, Father said, was that James I did whatever he pleased and raised his son, Charles I, to be equally pig-headed. And the result of that was Cromwell and the Revolution, and Charles I having his head chopped off. That was exactly what could be expected, Father implied, for any royal family not intelligent enough to listen to a man like Coke. And of course, Johnny learned by the time he was at Eton, Lord Coke had triumphed in the long run. The Stuarts were not kings at all anymore, although a handful of wild Irishmen and crazy Scots, the Jacobites, wanted to bring them back. But Lord Coke was studied in every college of law in Great Britain, and you had to read some parts of his work even in an ordinary public school. It was after Father met Mr. John Wilkes, the demagogue, that John, by then in his teens, began to hear about those passages in Coke that said Parliament, just like the king, could not do anything it pleased but must obey the Constitution, and about Thomas Reed, the Scotsman, who argued that the pursuit of happiness was the only rational goal of man and the only justification for government. But Reed and Wilkes and even Lord Coke were all, somehow, implicit in that early experience of that one ineluctable Dublin tombstone that was to remain forever, as Father had intended, the goad and goal of John's sense of conscience. He has gone where fierce indignation can no longer lacerate his heart. Go, traveler, imitate him if you can. He served liberty. Something else that had an equally powerful impact on John's mind occurred when he was at Eton. The master of the geometry class was a man named Robert Estlin Drake, a tall blonde man who had a habit of using geometry as a launching pad for excursions into logic and philosophy generally. He delighted in presenting the class with paradoxes for which there was no known solution. John learned all about Achilles and the tortoise in that class, and the arrow in flight that never moved, and even about Bishop Berkeley's proof that nothing existed until it was perceived. Then one day, Drake discussed Plato's idea that we would not be able to conceive of equality if there were not another world in which perfect equality did exist. This must be true, the argument ran, because we cannot deduce equality from this world, where only approximations of it exist. One student, a boy named Jeffrey Wildeblood, decided Plato was right. The other world where equality exists, he said, must be the mind of Bishop Berkeley's God. Ah, Drake said, delighted. I have actually prodded one of you to read the good bishop. But think of the implications, Wildeblood Major. Perfect justice must also exist in that ideal realm, as Plato also pointed out. And perfect knowledge, and perfect music. Does that not all follow, Wildeblood Major? Yes, sir, Wildeblood said boldly. Nobody has ever seen a perfect chicken coop, Drake said, and paused. Every chicken coop in England, or on the continent, or far off in Asia, is just an approximation of perfection. Therefore, in that perfect realm of Plato's, or in the mind of God, there must be a perfect chicken coop toward which we can only approximate, and it would include perfect hens, perfect roosters, perfect eggs, and perfect chicken shit. Is that not a remarkable thought? The class was in an uproar. Drake pounded his cane on the desk to restore silence. Babcock Major, he said, you look uncommonly perplexed. Do you think my examples of the chicken coop has reduced Plato to absurdity? John rose, as was required. No, sir, he answered sharply. I think there is something wrong with our logic, sir. We invent better machines all the time, sir. I think some day we will invent a better logic and all these paradoxes will be solved, sir. Drake nodded thoughtfully. I had forgotten that your father is a judge, Babcock Major. That is the most interesting answer I have ever heard to that problem. If you ever succeed in inventing such an improved logic, pray make haste to inform me of it at your earliest convenience. Somehow, this led to a new nickname being appended to John. Throughout Eton, not just in his own class, he became Better Logic Babcock. Worse, he was continually being asked if he had found the precise second T when A turned into not A. Various wits inquired of him if he had found a new geometry yet, or if he was currently working on the foundations of a new number series. All these matters of ontological analysis became quite concrete and urgent when John happened to think of them while receiving a caning from an apoplectic master named Murdstone, a nasty old twit with all the warmth and sentiment of a female praying mantis. Murdstone was also eager to find an excuse to cane a boy. John, of course, accepted caning as he accepted the moon and stars. It was part of the way things were. But this time, suddenly, John thought of the tombstone in Dublin declaring a love of liberty so fierce that it lacerated the heart. He abruptly suspected that his original rage at being caned might have been justified and that learning to tolerate it merely showed that he was afraid to question some things that really deserved to be looked at skeptically. If Lord Coke could, at least posthumously, convince the kings of England that their powers were limited, could not somebody, some day, tell the masters of Eton that their power over the students was also limited? It was only a thought. John knew full well what would happen if he seized the cane and tried to fight back against Murdstone. Then something even more dramatic occurred. John fell in love. The boy was the other heretic in geometry class, Jeffrey Wildeblood, who believed that there was a perfect chicken coop in the mind of God. One day in 1760, all the boys at Eton were excused from their classes and taken to the chapel. The masters were very grim, and everybody knew that somebody was going to catch blue hell. The chaplain, Father Fenwick, had once been a papist, everybody knew it, but he had been a good Anglican for more than 20 years now, and all the old rumors about his involvement with Jacobite plots were discredited. He was around 50 and was considered a good sort by the boys, your cheerful, kindly clergyman, not your stuffy, stiff-necked variety. But today he looked like thunder and lightning when he stood up in the pulpit. Some of the boys have been stealing wine from the sacristy again, John thought. I must speak today about a terrible, terrible subject, Father Fenwick said, in a tone that suggested that at least grave robbery and black magic were involved, if not axe murder. I would to God that I did not have to let words of such vile matters pass my lips, but it is necessary to speak out at this time. There are many kinds of sin, but some are so loathsome that even to name them is revolting to people of sensibility. There is one sin in particular that is known to appear often in schools such as this, where many boys are living together in close proximity for long periods of time. I speak of the abomination that is both against nature and against Scripture. You all know the story of Sodom and Gomorrah. Oh, Jesus, John thought, they know. Perhaps I will shoot myself with a pistol as soon as I get out of here. Father Fenwick talked at length about the sin of sodomy. He said that God had destroyed the whole city of Sodom with fire and brimstone because this sin was so hateful to him. He said that this vice was so vile that gentlemen never even talked about it, although they may make jokes about other sins of the flesh. He said that the authorities at Eton did not want to believe at first that a nest of monsters was among them, but there were so many rumors that an investigation had been made. He said that 18 practitioners of this hideous vice were now known. My God, John thought, who are the other 16? Father Fenwick said that if the culprits came to him and confessed, they could receive absolution, but they must swear to God to forsake their unspeakable vice, or the absolution would be a deception of God and magnify their guilt. And we will all be watched, John thought, from that day forward. We will be policed as if we lived in the lands of the Inquisition. He was wondering if some of this cant might not be a huge bluff. Suppose his name were not on their list. Then by confessing he would just be sticking his neck in the noose for no reason at all. But if his name were on their list and he didn't come forth. Those of the 18 who do not come to me to confess in privacy, Father Fenwick said, will be regarded as obdurate in their vice. The school will have no choice. Such boys will be expelled, and their parents will be informed of the reason for their removal. Suppose Geoffrey doesn't confess, John thought. Then if I confess, I must name him. They will insist on that, and he will be sent home in disgrace. But suppose I do not confess, and Geoffrey does, then I will be the one sent home in disgrace. Father Fenwick talked on and on and on. John realized that this had all been rehearsed, plotted out like a Neapolitan conspiracy. The talk would go on and on, convoluted and repetitious and rambling as an old man's yarns, and the monotony would raise the apprehensions of the guilty. None of the boys would be let out of the chapel until the emotional effect was exactly as planned. They have done this before, he thought. Maybe they do it every 6 years, or every 10 years. They may have made a science out of it. He was beginning to analyze the situation. Probably, he thought, they will have some way to keep us apart so that we cannot talk. If two of us promise not to betray each other, the whole system fails. It depends on each of us thinking that he cannot be sure the other will not inform first. He dared not look around, to try to catch Geoffrey's eye. They were probably watching like hawks, to see which boys were looking at which other boys. Father Fenwick went on talking about the dreadful effects of the vice. He spoke of emasculation, feeble-mindedness, insanity, and incurable diseases. He said that practitioners seldom survived into adulthood unless the sin was relinquished. Their hands tremble, he said gravely. Their eyesight begins to fade. They cannot concentrate on their studies. How much can I trust Geoffrey? He said he loved me, but... Suddenly, the talk was coming to an end. I will now go to the rectory, Father Fenwick said. You will be led out of chapel one by one in intervals of 5 minutes. You will each come to the rectory, and either you will tell me that you have nothing to confess, or else you will make your confession, and we will pray together that God will forgive you and give you the strength to resist this bestial vice in the future. The priest left the pulpit.
Ainsley Minor, shouted Mr. Murdstone.
Bleeding Christ, John thought. They are doing it in alphabetical order, of course. I will go very soon, and Geoffrey Wildeblood will have a long, long wait, wondering if I peached on him or not. It seemed an eternity before Murdstone called, Babcock Major. John crossed the quad, very aware that the chestnut trees were blooming beautifully, very aware that the sky was the same shade of blue as Geoffrey's eyes. Eyes that go all the way back to heaven, Dubliners say. Very aware that he was about to make the most difficult decision of his young life. It doesn't matter, he thought in an instant of total despair, whether I confess at once. He will see it in my eyes, and he will keep me there, hounding me, until I do confess. He opened the door to the rectory. Father Fenwick was seated at his desk. He looked up blandly. Yes, Babcock Major? I have nothing to confess, sir. Pause. A long searching look from dark eyes. Are you sure, Babcock Major?
Yes, sir.
You old swine. Another pause. Let me sweat a minute.
You may go, Babcock Major.
Thank you, sir. John crossed the quad again, heading back to his room. I never knew I could lie to an adult and get away with it, he thought. And I was able to do it because I remembered the caning and realized what they are. This is not just a school, he thought. This is an institution for the production of automatons. It is run by automatons who were produced by other automatons long ago. And now they have forgotten what it is to be human and are engaged in turning us into automatons in turn. He remembered the story that had been in the London newspapers a few months ago. It had been written in very veiled language, but everybody knew what it meant, and many of the older boys made jokes about it. A brothel had been uncovered that specialized in caning men. Of course, he thought, some of the automatons get to like being caned, and some of them get to like doing the caning, and they come here and become masters or headmasters. And when the gears turn a certain way, a boy gets caned, and nobody dares question whether it is fair or not, because we are all becoming automatons here, and automatons do not ask questions. They move us as the gears move them. He was back in his room alone. Henson Minor and Montgomery Minor, who shared the room, would not be back for a while, since the Inquisition was proceeding alphabetically. No, they were not exactly automatons, but they did not know what they were doing. They take down a boy's breeches. They stare at his buttocks. They cane him until the buttocks bleed. And they believe this is virtue, because it is done in a school, and it becomes vice only if it is done in a place with a red lantern over the door. How long would it be before he learned if Geoffrey had confessed? John tried to distract himself. He opened a book by his favorite writer, the man whose tombstone spoke of fierce indignation. He found himself reading over and over, with no amusement at all. Last week, I saw a woman flayed, and you will hardly believe how much it altered her person for the worse. Yesterday, I ordered the carcass of a beau to be stripped in my presence, when we were all amazed to see so many unsuspected faults under one suit of clothes. Then I laid open his brain, his heart, and his spleen. But I plainly perceived at every operation that the further we proceeded, we found the defects increase upon us in number and bulk. From all which, I justly formed this conclusion to myself, that whatever philosopher or projector can find out an art to solder and patch up the flaws and imperfections of nature will deserve much better of mankind and teach us a more useful science than that so much in present esteem of widening and exposing them, like him who held anatomy to be the ultimate end of physic. And he, whose fortunes and dispositions have placed him in a convenient station to enjoy the fruits of this noble art, he that can with Epicurus content his ideas with the films and images of things, such a man truly wise, creams off nature, leaving the sour and dregs for philosophy and reason to lap up. This is the sublime and refined point of felicity, called the possession of being well deceived, the serene, peaceful state of being a fool among knaves. John had enjoyed that passage before, but now the irony seemed tinged with something more than a little sinister. This was as comic as the murder of Christ. It was the joke of a man who jokes because the only alternative is to scream down the house. Lord, how many hours will this go on? I saw a woman flayed. Yes, and you could still see that any time you cared to go to Newgate Hill. One could be quite sure it would alter her person for the worse, and it would alter all the other persons on Newgate Hill for the worse, although they might not realize it. You could see a boy caned any day at Eton, and caning was not really very different from flaying. Henson returned finally, and a little later, Montgomery. They both put on great airs of amusement and cynicism. But John was wondering if either of them had been guilty, unbeknown to him. And he knew they were wondering the same about him, and maybe about each other. Mystery and suspicion will hang over this class for years, he realized. Finally, it was time for dinner. No word had come for John to come to the headmaster's office. Geoffrey had not confessed. John felt a faint guilt for doubting Geoffrey at all. Mr. Murdstone made a brief speech when all the boys were in the dining hall. He said that 30 confessions had been obtained, not the 18 they expected, John noted. Murdstone added that one boy had run away somewhere, but would probably soon be found. Then he told them all, in solemn tones, that no further discussion of this matter would be allowed, inside the school or out, and warned them all that the school itself would be disgraced if any breath of this scandal ever went beyond the walls. Father Fenwick then made another speech. He said that all 30 culprits were truly repentant and that nobody should attempt to learn their identities. That must remain a matter between the boys themselves and our Father in heaven, he said. And everybody will know in a week, John thought, or at least everybody will pretend to know. Then he noticed that Geoffrey was not in the dining hall. Geoffrey was the boy who had run away. Jesus, Jesus, he thought. Just when I thought it was over, the worst is yet to come. He never remembered what was served for dinner that night. Somewhere, out there in the darkness, Geoffrey was wandering, frightened. Where could he go? Not home, certainly. Was he fantasizing about running away with gypsies, becoming a cabin boy on a ship to America? Or was he just in a blue funk and walking on and on like a horse with a blind staggers? God help him, John thought, if he falls into the hands of the highwaymen. Probably the sheriff's men would pick Geoffrey up tomorrow. With that starched collar, they would know at once he was from Eton and would bring him back here. And then, terrified, week after the night's ordeal, Geoffrey would confess everything. Expulsion. John tried to imagine the look in Father's eyes when he returned home, convicted sodomite. That was legally a hanging offense, but John had never heard of anyone actually being hanged for it. Probably you were just sent off to America or to the continent. Still, according to the books, they could hang you if they wanted to. Geoffrey was probably thinking about that, out there in the dark. Geoffrey knew all about sodomy and its implications. He said he had always known he was that way, as far back as he could remember. John was not sure about himself. He often had fantasies about girls. If girls had been available, well then, he might be in another kind of trouble. But that was pointless now. Whatever calamity was going to befall him, it was because he had loved Geoffrey, not a girl. It was not only sinful but dangerous with a girl because she might get pregnant. It was unnatural with a boy because he wouldn't get pregnant. That seemed to leave the sheep, but no, that was abominable. There was your own right hand, but that led to blindness. I think they are lying to us about some of that, John thought. Damn it, where was Geoffrey, and what was happening to him out there in the dark? At 8 in the evening, the news arrived at West Hall, where John lodged. Geoffrey Wildeblood had been found in a pond, dead. We must in charity assume that he fell in by accident, said Mr. Drake, who had brought the story. The poor lad will then be given a Christian burial. For the sake of his grieved parents, let none of you breathe a word to the contrary. Remember, I pray you, that all we know for certain is that the poor lad drowned. All else is inference. Spreading unfavorable inference is the sin of scandal condemned in Holy Writ. John realized that he felt nothing.
Maybe I am just numb with shock, he thought. Or maybe I'm one of those monsters without normal human feelings. John pictured Jeffrey floating in the pond, nausea swept over him. He thought for a moment that he would lose his dinner, but that was horror, not true grief. What has happened to me? He wondered. Has part of me died today, along with Jeffrey? All those starched, eaten collars, he thought, and nobody knows what goes on in the heads above them. Future prime ministers and future leading figures of all sorts, all learning to hide emotions and become English gentlemen. 30 confessed. Jeffrey and I did not confess, and the others? God alone could answer. He was awake long after the candles were extinguished, still not feeling anything. Perhaps grief is this way, he thought. It takes a few days before you feel it. Then I laid open his brain, his heart, and his spleen, but I plainly perceived at every operation that the further we proceeded, we found the defects increase upon us in number and bulk. Jeffrey was too sensitive, basically. He could not stand the normal teasing and the cruel wit of the boys at Eton. He was easily hurt and depressed. Jeffrey killed himself because they put him in a trap, and he broke under the strain. Everything that appears imperfect here on earth has a perfect model in the mind of God. Jeffrey really had believed that. Then there is a perfect Eton in the mind of God, John thought. The system works perfectly there. Everybody confesses. Nobody lies. Nobody jumps in the pond. And they all graduate and turn into perfect English gentlemen. And the best of them, the cream of the cream, the pluperfect of the perfect, arrive eventually in a perfect House of Lords and snore perfectly while perfect bills are perfectly debated. And the hangmen are all perfect there. When they flay a whore, they use perfect whips. I know why Jeffrey killed himself, John thought. He would not betray me, but he could not walk into the rectory and lie to Father Fenwick. He might have walked toward the rectory door many times, but each time he would walk away, walk around the quad again, probably stopping to look at the old whipping block from the 14th century. Do they keep that there to show how far we have progressed since then, or to warn us of what they are capable of doing if rebellion ever appears? He would walk back and forth, trying to get his courage up. He could not look at the priest and lie. So he threw himself in the pond and died. Around dawn, John thought, I will never see him again. That is what death means. Shakespeare put it in 5 words. Never, 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 never. No part of him that I haven't kissed, no part of me that he hasn't kissed, and I will never, 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 never see him again. John began to feel something finally. Not grief. His mind still held that at bay. He felt a fierce indignation that lacerated his heart. It will be a lonely life, he thought, living a lie, but that is the condition of survival in this place at this time, and I will throw the lie in their teeth eventually. Some day, somehow. Part 7. The Devil. But there is one dangerous element in Freemasonry, and that is the element I've copied from them. Adolf Hitler, quoted in Hermann Rauschning, Hitler Speaks. At 18, Sigismundo Cellini was attending the University of Napoli, where the great Tommaso di Aquino had once taught. Sigismundo was majoring in mathematics, not music, because he had decided nobody in Napoli could teach him anything about the kind of music he wanted to write. Someday, in a few years, he would go to Hamburg and study with those who had been pupils of Telemann. In the meanwhile, he was still composing experimental sonatas. He had almost finished one symphony in the French style, but had thrown it out as hopeless. Mathematics more and more obsessed him. The relation between music and mathematics seemed to him the most exciting and most mysterious of all areas of knowledge,
Ever since he had understood those wonderful English machines as concretized thoughts, he had wanted to learn more and more and more about the kind of coherence that appears only in equations. That kind of knowledge could yield machines that would endlessly magnify human wealth. He believed it also brought humanity closer to the real structure of the universe, the way God thinks. And one day after his 18th birthday, Sigismundo had gone to Uncle Pietro and said, "I think I'm old enough now to join your club." "I must ask you 3 times, Pietro said somberly. "Are you sure you are ready to commit yourself?" "Yes," Sigismundo said fervently. "Think, now, as I ask again. Are you truly sure?" "Yes." "Think again, and don't answer so fast. Are you sure you are ready to commit yourself?" Sigismundo thought. "The Rossi will never stop dogging me. This means that the Inquisitors will dog me also some day." "Yes," he said flatly. "I am absolutely sure." "Very well," Pietro said. "We are, as you have guessed, the ancient and accepted order of Freemasons, also known as the Order of the Oriental Temple. We were driven underground in 1307 when the Inquisitors stumbled upon some of our secrets, which they could not understand. We have changed our name many times, and even now we have a different title in Arabic countries than we have in Europe. There are many others who claim to be Templars and Masons who are not of us. They are mere pretenders and charlatans. We alone possess the original, unbroken tradition of inner light, preserved since the days of Solomon. Do you believe that?" "No," Sigismundo said promptly. "Every club claims to be the original and genuine. I believe you and your friends are the most rational people around here, but that's all I believe so far." "Very good," Pietro chuckled. "Sometimes I believe we are the original, on Sundays, Tuesdays, and Thursdays. The other 4 days, I'm not so sure who invented our club or when. It doesn't matter. Speculative masonry, in our form, seems to me the best hope for improving the lot of humanity in a world full of fanatics." "When can I be initiated?" Sigismundo demanded. "In a few days. I must call a meeting of the lodge. Meanwhile, there is a piece of paper I must give you with questions. You must think about them every minute. Even give up music and neglect your university studies for these days. Think about nothing but these questions." Pietro went to his bookshelves and rummaged about. "Here it is," he said. Sigismundo looked at the parchment. "Who was Adam the son of?" "Morte de Cristo," he thought. "That's as bad as the old one about where did Cain get his wife." He looked at the rest of the questions. "Does God have an opposite? How many sons of God are there? Are the sons of God also gods? Are any sons of God less than others? What is the goal of prophets and teachers? How many minds are there? What is a human being? Is mankind finished or in process? How much can we and should we attempt? What is the purpose of life and consciousness? What is the next step?" Sigismundo grinned. "Thanks a lot," he said. "If the Belladonna didn't drive me crazy, these riddles certainly will." He spent most of that day rereading Genesis many times. Adam, of course, did not have a father. The first question was either pointless or very sneaky. He tried pondering the next question. Does God have an opposite? The obvious answer was, yes, the devil. Was he supposed to deny this? That wouldn't be too hard, since he already doubted hell. But if there was no devil, how account for evil? That was a subtle trap. You might end up attributing evil to God. And the third question, how many sons of God are there? There was only one, the perfect man, Jesus. Any other answer was heresy. And yet Abraham, who was a Jew, could not accept Jesus as the only son of God in Orthodox Catholic fashion, and Abraham was a Freemason. So there was some other clearly heretical answer. He remembered Peppino's words, "As for the foul Mohammedans, you have joined them already." Was he supposed to think that Mohammed was also a son of God? And maybe there were others. The Chinese had their own prophet, Confucius. The Hindus had many prophets and seers. Was the Masonic heresy that all these men were equally the sons of God? Did they hope to unite mankind with that relativistic idea,
If so, if that doctrine ever leaked out, the Masons would be condemned by the Church at once.
Sigismundo skipped down the page to, "What is the purpose of life and consciousness?" That was a rare beauty, that one.
"Let me try it from the other end," he decided. "I'm about to become a Freemason. If I know what that means, I will know how to approach these questions."
Free. Free to do what? He thought of the free market and the abolition of tariffs, of freedom of thought and the end of the Inquisition, of freedom from every form of tyranny.
He liked the sound of all that, but it didn't tell him who Adam was the son of.
Mason. Builder. A Freemason was a free builder, not just in the literal sense, obviously. The man with a steam engine in Scotland, Watt, was a free Mason in the sense that he had built something new, out of the freedom of his own mind, not being told what he must and must not think.
"Wealth increases where ideas are free," Uncle Pietro always said.
"I am free when I write a sonata," Sigismundo thought. "But music is not wealth, or is it? Publishers pay to print our melodies. People buy the scores to learn to play them. Other people pay to go to the opera and listen. By God, music is a kind of wealth. Even poetry is wealth. How many innkeepers in Stratford are making money every year because tourists go to see the place Shakespeare is buried? Any product of the mind is wealth if people want it. To set the mind free, totally free, everywhere, in everybody, would increase wealth just as rapidly as Uncle Pietro claimed. All kinds of wealth, dozens of kinds that we can't even imagine yet. How many sons of God are there?" Sigismundo could not sit still. Despite Pietro's instructions, he went to the clavicembalo and began improvising. He had too much energy. He could not think about these questions anymore. He began trying variations on the Goldberg Variations by J.S. Bach. He constructed new counterpoints. He returned to the original. He went back to variations again, then back to Bach. This J.S. Bach had indeed written the music Sigismundo longed for, the music of the human mind, above animal emotion, the music of the clear light. And yet it was music that delighted the animal soul, too, and reached down to the vegetative levels, too, because it included all three souls. More, it was groping toward the fourth soul. He played on and on, adding more and more, making permutations on Bach's permutations. This was music for the clavicembalo only. To imagine it adapted for a string quartet, say, or even a trio of any kind, was to imagine a different beauty, not this special, stark, clear, lucid, unique loveliness. Old Bach, father of J.C. and C.P.E., must have been in ecstasy when he wrote this. He was seeing more of the naked essence of being than anybody but the greatest mathematicians. Sigismundo was suddenly drained. He could play no more. He was exhausted. Who was Adam the son of? Sigismundo came out of his body again, as often happened with the best music, but this time was different. He was not outside the world itself, as in his previous ecstasies, not at all. He was emphatically still in this room. He seemed to be somewhere near the ceiling. He was looking down at himself, seated at the clavicembalo. "This is most amusing," he thought. "I look like 11 dozen other Neapolitan youths, the same curly black hair, the same dark Mediterranean skin, the same Mephisto beard and mustache. I'm stocky, but not fat. God, I look tired. Am I really out of my body, or am I so excited that I'm imagining things? What is the purpose of life and consciousness?" He was back in his body and his chest hurt. He thought, in alarm, that's what killed Aunt Gina, the swelling of the heart. The light was still with him. Everything in the room was shining, brilliant, incandescent. His eyes watered, not from emotion, but from something else. "It is like looking into the sun," he thought. "But I can't look away from it, the way you look away from the sun. This light is everywhere." And the light was everywhere for the next 3 hours. He tried to escape it by taking a walk, but it was the same in the streets. The whole world had changed, as if the sun had become 1,000 times brighter. The burning coal symbol of the carbonari, he thought. This is what it means. His eyes were watering continually, but at least the pain in his chest was going away.
He was happier than he had ever been. If the Rossi jumped out of a door, finally, and stabbed him, he would die with a smile. By dinner time, he was mostly back to normal, but his appetite was immense. Mama made a joke that he would get fat. Nobody seemed to notice that he was in a distinctly odd frame of mind. Very provocative questions, he thought when he returned to his room. Who was Adam the son of? How many minds are there? He didn't go out of his body again. He just became increasingly abstracted. The intensity of colors faded away. The world faded away. He might have been working on a mathematical problem. After dark, when everybody else was asleep, he was sitting on the veranda, staring at the stars but hardly seeing them. There might be minds out there asking the same questions, more or less. That was why the church had burned Giordano Bruno at the stake in Rome in 1600, for saying that there were other minds out there, minds like ours, and minds nothing like ours at all, minds of all sorts, infinite minds. Bruno said that the universe did not have a beginning or an end, and that human beings were a very small part of it. If Bruno was right, there were minds everywhere in space. And the microscope had already shown there was a city, a whole kingdom, in any drop of water. How many minds are there? How many sons of God are there? Sigismundo went to sleep in the swing chair, looking at the red glare of Sirius in the south, and wondering if he was traveling to that star or only dreaming about it. From Maria Maldonado's Journal. Mother Ursula told me that anyone could learn to interpret dreams, just as Joseph did in the Bible. She says the whole art is in three steps. First, one must learn to remember one's dreams. Second, by meditating on them, one can eventually understand them. And third, with this knowledge mastered, one can begin to interpret the dreams of others. To remember one's dreams, Mother Ursula says, it is necessary to keep fool's cap by one's bed and write down all that one remembers of the night's dreams the very first thing on awakening. She says that if one does this every day, one remembers more every day. 1. February 2nd. Last night I dreamed that a snake got into the convent garden. Papa killed it. 5. March 3rd. The images of the Egyptian gods Isis and Osiris. Somebody talking about ghosts. I think I must get out of this place before it is too late. 8. March 23rd. A boy has fallen into a well or pond. He is drowning. I want to save him, but then I realize that it's very far away and I can't reach him in time. He has a starched white collar, and I'm terrified to see him sinking. My brother Carlo dives in to try to save him. 17. March 31st. Mother Ursula gives me a book. It is called How to Find a Lost Cat. Somehow I know that this book is very important. I open it, and the first chapter is called North Gods versus South Gods. Papa comes in and is most angry. He says girls should not read such books. 23. April 23rd. I am being condemned by the Inquisition for hoarding darts. I become terribly angry and indiscreet. I tell the judges that they have made themselves stupid by refusing to collect their own darts. I suddenly realize that what I'm saying does not make sense. 56. May 7th. Very strange. I dreamed of ants infesting my room. When I woke, there was a cloud formation over the sun, making a splotched pattern on the floor, just like the pattern made by the ants in my dream. 93. June 6th. Papa is very worried. He tells me that there are no more snakes in any of the Italian states. I try to tell him that we do not need snakes, and some of them are venomous anyway. He says that I do not understand. It is the snakes that bring prosperity, he says. I realize that this man is not Papa at all, but some sinister black magician who is impersonating Papa. I try to leave the room, but the door is locked. Suddenly, he grapples with me, attempting to tear my clothes off. Somehow, I am outside in the garden. But the evil magician is pursuing me, so I try to find my way to the street. There is a black woman who offers to help me. She says her name is Fatima.
We go to a place where a huge black dog keeps guard. The dog sits with tremendous dignity, and I've a feeling that he is not a dog at all, but some pagan god in the form of a dog. Fatima tells me, "You need never fear us. We are your dark companions." I realize that she is secretly in league with the evil magician. Of course, it gets easier to read the meanings, just as Mother Ursula said. This dream means that Father wants me to get married off soon. Sigismundo Cellini's initiation as a speculative Freemason occurred on the night of July 23, 1768. He had been puzzling over Uncle Pietro's questions for 5 days and had gone through stages of ecstasy, irritation, boredom, increased sensitivity, and sudden flashes of anger at the whole mystifying business. If the Masons had something important to teach, he thought, in these moments of rebellion, why not just teach it and be done? But he knew the answer. From music, he had already discovered that some things simply cannot be taught. They can only be learned. On the evening of July 23rd, Sigismundo was in the living room of Giancarlo Tanone, his fencing teacher, with Uncle Pietro. "The lodge meets in the garden," Uncle Pietro explained. "You can probably guess why." Sigismundo understood. Tanone's house had the traditional Mediterranean architecture, with four wings, each wing being the side of a square. The garden formed the middle and was therefore the furthest spot from any streets or neighboring houses. It was the place most invulnerable to spies, especially if each wing of the house had a lookout stationed to ensure that no stranger approached uninvited. Tanone stepped into the room from the garden. He was wearing a lambskin apron with 5 Hebrew letters on it. Even though Sigismundo's knowledge of the language was scant, he could read that word. The letters were Yad, He, Shin, Vau, He. Yeshua, or, in Greek, Jesus. Without the Shin, it was Yad, He, Vau, He, J-H-V-H, or Jehovah. The Shin, which looked like a flame, represented the descent of the Holy Spirit of Jehovah into the flesh, in the form of the man, Jesus. "Prepare the candidate," Tanone said in a tone that conveyed no admission that he had known Sigismundo for 7 years. Tanone quickly stepped back into the garden and closed the door behind him. "By now," Uncle Pietro said, "the questions I gave you have turned into monstrous problems. I will now give you the answers. Read them quickly because you will be summoned to the garden in only a few minutes." He went to Tanone's bookcase and removed the Holy Bible. With a solemn glance, he gave it to Sigismundo, who noticed at once that it had a parchment sticking out of it. "Read the parchment and consult the Bible," Pietro said. "I will leave now." He immediately exited into the garden, leaving Sigismundo wondering if the parchment might say, "This is the final joke. Beware the damnable books of philosophy along with those of romance." Sigismundo removed the parchment. It began, "Who was Adam the son of? See Luke 3:38. Does God have an opposite? See Exodus 3:14 and Ephesians 4:4-6. And so on." Oh, damn and blast, Sigismundo thought. Why didn't they just write in the text instead of forcing me to look each one up for myself? But the answer was clear. Hunting for each text under a time limit would increase his sense of urgency. He turned to the first question and its answer. Luke would be near the back of the Bible, of course. He quickly found chapter 3, verse 38. "Which was the son of Enos, which was the son of Seth, which was the son of Adam, which was the son of God." Sigismundo couldn't believe his eyes. He felt like Galileo seeing the blasphemous, unbelievable, non-Aristotelian spots on the sun. He scanned rapidly back through several verses. This was the genealogy of Jesus, whose name was on Tanone's apron. It began at verse 23, saying Jesus was the son of Joseph, and Joseph was the son of Heli, which was the son of Mathat, and so on, David and Solomon and all, until Enos. Which was the son of Seth, which was the son of Adam, which was the son of God, in verse 38 from which he had started. But Adam was the son of God, only metaphorically, wasn't he? But Vico said all thought was metaphor.
The text did not seem to be speaking poetically. It repeated, which was the son of, in what seemed to be a very literal sense each time until it reached that astonishing conclusion. It seemed to be saying that Adam was the son of God as literally as Joseph was the son of Heli. The Masons were indeed leading him into most extreme heresies. The idea that Mohammed was literally the son of God, and so was Confucius, and so were many others, could easily follow once you accepted that Jesus was not the only one, that Adam had been another. Sigismundo quickly turned to the next question. Does God have an opposite? See Exodus 3:14 and Ephesians 4, 4-6. He turned the pages rapidly. Exodus 3:14 said, "And God said unto Moses, I am that I am. And he said, Thus shalt thou say unto the children of Israel, I am, hath sent me unto you." And Ephesians 4, 4-6 was even more startling. "There is one body and one spirit, even as ye are called in one hope of your calling, one Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God and Father of all, who is above all, and through all, and in you all." Sigismundo thought of God as I am, as one body and one spirit in all. Even in Pipino, even in Caligula, this was pantheism, another doctrine for which Bruno had been condemned. Were the Masons secret followers of Bruno? He rushed on to the next question. How many sons of God are there? See Romans 8, 14-17. Here we come to the heart of the heresy, he thought, but he looked up the text. "For as many as are led by the Spirit of God, they are the sons of God. For ye have not received the spirit of bondage again to fear, for ye have received the spirit of adoption, whereby we cry, Abba, Father. The Spirit beareth witness with our spirit that we are the children of God, and if children, then heirs, heirs of God, and joint heirs with Christ, if so be that we suffer with him, that we may also be glorified." Everybody was a child of God, not just Adam and Jesus, and the Bible said so. Sigismundo had never heard that in religious knowledge class. He went on to the next question. "Are the sons of God also gods? See John 10:34. Sigismundo turned pages impatiently. Jesus answered them, "Is it not written in your law, I said, ye are gods?" There it was in black and white. Are any sons of gods less than others? See Colossians 3:4. When Christ, who is our life, shall appear, then shall ye appear with him in glory. In other words, Sigismundo thought, when you can see Christ, you are Christ. When your will becomes one with the will of God, as Abraham said. What is the goal of prophets and teachers? See Ephesians 4, 11-13. "And he gave some apostles, and some prophets, and some evangelists, and some pastors and teachers, for the perfecting of the saints, for the work of the ministry, for the edifying of the body of Christ, till we all come in the unity of the faith, and of the knowledge of the Son of God, unto a perfect man, unto the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ." We are to be raised to perfection, Sigismundo thought, just as the French atheists say. But here the Bible is saying it too. He rushed on, turning pages rapidly. How many minds are there? He had thought billions and billions all over space. What he read did not contradict that, but gave a new perspective on it. See Deuteronomy 4:39 and Exodus 3:14. "Know therefore this day, and consider it in thine heart, that the Lord he is God in heaven above and upon the earth beneath. There is none else. And God said unto Moses, I am that I am." Sigismundo rushed on. What is a human being? See Genesis 1:26. "And God said, Let us make man in our image, after our likeness." Is mankind finished or in process? See 1 John 3:2. "Beloved, now are we the sons of God, and it doth not appear what we shall be,
But we know that when he shall appear, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. How much can we and should we attempt? See John 14:12. Verily, verily, I say unto you, he that believeth in me, the works that I do he shall do also, and greater works than these shall he do. But that was the heresy of the alumbrados, the doctrine that we could all perform the miracles of Christ if we were illuminated. What is the purpose of life and consciousness? See 2 Corinthians 9:8 and Luke 12:32. And God is able to make all grace abound toward you, that ye, having always all sufficiency in all things, may abound to every good work. Fear not, little flock, for it is your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. And the last question, finally. What is the next step? See Romans 8:19. This will be the knockout blow, Sigismundo thought, turning pages. The text leaped out at him. For the earnest expectation of the creature awaiteth the manifestation of the sons of God. Psst, Uncle Pietro whispered. Come out now. Beautifully timed, Sigismundo thought. They were watching to see when I finished. He walked toward the garden with his mind in a whirl of confusion and excitement. They have me, he thought, in a state where any shock will be like great music or that moment of first walking into the Tempio Malatesta. The whole garden had been transformed. A huge tent had been set up in the middle of it. There was a silver altar with a Bible in the east. The well in the west had been painted gold, and everybody was wearing those lambskin aprons and had blue garters on their thighs. Abraham Orfale, in the Arabic robe, stood before the tent. Fellow soldiers, he said, assist me. What is the first duty of a master mason? To guard the camp, said Uncle Pietro, now also in Arabic garb. You have already joined the foul Mohammedans, Peppino had warned. Let the camp be guarded, said old Abraham. Two strange men in Arabic clothing left the garden. Most mysterious master, Uncle Pietro said, the camp is guarded. What is the second duty of a master mason? Abraham demanded. To see that all present are true brothers, Uncle Pietro replied. Sigismundo by now recognized Tanoni in the gloom, and Father Ratti, and Robert Francis Drake with his blonde hair, and, life is full of surprises, Count Maldonado. Others were merchants he had noticed at one time or another around town. A few were strangers. Are all true brothers? Uncle Pietro demanded. All raised their arms to make an L in the air, then moved them into a V, then crossed them in an X. L-V-X, light, Sigismundo thought. How many officers has the camp? Abraham asked. Three visible, Uncle Pietro replied. And eight invisible, Tanone stated. Sigismundo felt a shiver. They're really giving me the full treatment, he thought. Eight invisible? Who have you here? Old Abraham asked. The son of a widow lady, who has been drawn to our oasis and received the hospitality of our camp, Uncle Pietro said. He is a seeker for the Grail. Halt, Abraham cried. Do you understand, he asked Sigismundo coldly, that by entering our camp you have incurred the penalty of death? Sigismundo stared, unable to answer. The first time was a joke, he thought. The second time was a horror. This time may make the second time look like another joke by comparison. They are magicians, like the Rossi. They also want to use me. Say yes, Uncle Pietro whispered. Yes, Sigismundo said, unconvinced. Tanone, Count Maldonado, and Father Ratti suddenly surrounded Sigismundo and put daggers to his throat. He again recalled his experience with Orosi. Do you consider the honor of enrolling yourself among us as a full compensation for this doom? Abraham asked. Yes, Sigismundo said, bewildered. The daggers were withdrawn. Sigismundo was led around the garden by Uncle Pietro. At each of the four corners, where the guardian angels would stand if Abraham were doing a healing,
where the four demons would be if this were a Rossi ritual. A man in a lambskin apron stopped them. In a hostile tone, he demanded to know who Sigismundo was. The son of a poor widow lady, Pietro answered each time. This is Chapel Perilous, Sigismundo thought. I am in the role of Parsifal, the poor widow's son. But then the castration of Peppino would be the wound of Klingsor, and that wasn't part of a ritual. What did Abraham tell me about coincidences being part of the path? Sigismundo was returned to Abraham. In all cases of difficulty and danger, in whom do you put your trust? Abraham demanded. In God, Sigismundo replied. Take him out, Abraham cried with a great show of anger. He is not one of us. Sigismundo was led back into the living room by Uncle Pietro, who did not appear at all friendly. A Freemason does not know more than one mind, Pietro explained impatiently. You spoke as one still blinded by false dualism. You will never get out of Chapel Perilous or find the Grail that way. Go back in and give the right answer this time. You will not be given a second chance. Sigismundo and Pietro returned to the garden. The whole ceremony started again from the beginning. Fellow soldiers, assist me. Let the camp be guarded. Three visible and eight invisible, the son of a poor widow lady. In cases of difficulty and danger, in whom do you put your trust? Abraham demanded a second time. There is one body and one spirit. In myself, Sigismundo said. I am glad your faith is so well founded, Abraham said. But I am bound to explain to you that it would have been better if you had never approached us, for this night you must surely die, and what will rise will not be you. Will you still persevere? Yes. Repeat after me, Abraham said somberly. I, Sigismundo Celline, a fool and a sinner. I, Sigismundo Celline, a fool and a sinner. In the presence of the powers of birth, visible and invisible. The oath went on and on. It seemed to contain many repetitions. Sigismundo began to fear that Dr. Orfali was putting him to sleep. When the oath was finally finished, somebody in the garden began beating a drum softly. Another began playing the flute. Sigismundo recognized the tune as Scottish. Then he recognized The Boy Who Is Born to Be King, a lament for Bonnie Prince Charlie, or for every man who did not know how to use his powers. Sigismundo was again taken on a tour of the north, east, south, and west. This was called Travels with the Moon. At each quarter, a man in a lambskin apron emblazoned Jesus said one sentence to him in turn. Learn to know. Learn to will. Learn to dare. Learn to keep silence. He was back at the tent, facing old Abraham, who now looked darker and more Arabic than ever. This whole ritual is doing something to my mind, he admitted to himself. Most mysterious master, Uncle Pietro said. The candidate has fulfilled the travels with the moon. Prepare him for the ordeal of fire, Abraham said in a most sinister tone. Sigismundo was suddenly seized and blindfolded. He was dragged around the garden again, but not in a regular path over the four quarters. This time he was deliberately being disoriented. O Christ, he thought, the ordeal by fire. He hated that kind of pain, and it reminded him of the Dominican howling about eternal fire. How much would he be burned, and how severe was the ordeal in general? Suddenly he was loose. Nobody was holding him. He had no idea where in the garden he was. Blindfolded and waiting in suspense, he did the relaxing breath, vowing to be brave. All was silent. The drum and flute had stopped. Nobody spoke. The seconds passed like giant turtles lugubriously trekking across the sands towards the water. And the earth was without form and void, Abraham's voice said suddenly. Sigismundo, in total blindness and anxiety, waited. Nothing happened. Nobody spoke. Get it over with, he thought. Burn me and complete it. Don't keep me sweating like this. Several rocks hit him at once. They were thrown from nearby, with careful aim. He was not seriously hurt, but the slight pain of each rock and the shock of the unexpected made him jump and yell.
an inarticulate shout, like a baby at birth, he thought. Hands grabbed him and he was lifted. Oh, Jesus, Jesus, he thought. He was dropped. The whole world has ceased to make sense. He was falling further than seemed possible. Chapel perilous. Price of admission, your mind. He had been waiting for fire, but instead was hit by rocks, and now he was flying, it seemed, through space. Fire, earth, the rocks, air. Then he hit the water. Mamma mia, he cried involuntarily, angry and frightened. This was becoming as much good clean fun as a public hanging. He had landed on his knees and banged his head. He stood up carefully, still blindfolded, up to his belly in cold water. I am in the well, he reasoned. That is why they hold the ritual in the garden, so they can throw the poor fish in the well when he's waiting to get burned. Fire and water are the same, the alchemist said. It was one of their riddles, only another alchemist could understand. I am being put through a dramatization of that riddle, he told himself. After Negrito, the dark night, comes the union of opposites. And God said, Let there be light, and there was light, Abraham chanted ecstatically above him. Sigismundo was in a different space again. He was far above the city looking down at Vesuvius and the bay. He was plunging toward the sun. Then he was the sun. There was nothing at all but limitless light. He was an old man, going blind but still writing music. That was in Leipzig. But then he was coming out of the water into Napoli again, crying, emerging from his mother. Then he was back in the camp again, but the old man was not Abraham or Folly, but Saladin. All this had happened long ago, during the Third Crusade. He was wearing the white tunic with the red cross on it that was the insignia of the Oriental Templars. Then he was in Philadelphia City, and a tall, red-headed man, who spoke a peculiar English with a drawl in it, was arguing that unalienable rights was more correct than inalienable rights. Sigismundo could not keep track of all the new things that were happening. He would still fight a duel with Carlo Maldonado. He had crossed a desert. He was a woman giving birth. He was captain of a strange yellow ship that traveled under the water. He could step in and out of space and time whenever he wished. Maybe I've gone as crazy as Antonio, he thought. He was blindfolded at the bottom of a well, and these people he trusted were definitely doing things to his mind that he did not understand. Maybe they were all Rossi, too, in a conspiracy within a conspiracy. Maybe everybody had lied to him all his life. Maybe he was being possessed by demons. Maybe this was the fulfillment of Peppino's prophecy that he would join the Rossi of his own free will. Maybe he had never been released by the Rossi and was still in their cave, hallucinating. Maybe the last 4 years were all hallucination. Then he was being raised out of the well by several hands. He almost seemed to be floating. And on the third day, Abraham intoned in the darkness, he rose again. Sigismundo, wet and dripping, was set on his feet. See the face of the eternal God, Uncle Pietro whispered. The blindfold was whipped off. Sigismundo was staring at a young man's face that stared back at him with a look of total astonishment, the perfect fool who understood nothing. Then the eyes. His eyes became less astonished and laughed as he realized they were holding a mirror in front of his face. He looked about, not sure if he were in 18th century Napoli or 11th century Jerusalem. Were you afraid? The old man, Abraham or Saladin, whoever, was asking him. Yes. That is the first lesson of wisdom, Abraham said, still looking like Saladin in his Arabic robe. Always remember this, I implore you. All men are savage beasts and will kill each other promiscuously if the goal of the true brotherhood is not attained. Sigismundo was led back into the living room. Tenone, without speaking, gave him a pure white robe. Sigismundo got out of his wet clothes, thinking he had been Osiris as well as Parsifal and Jesus in this ritual, wondering how his mind had created that pure blinding white light, thoroughly shaken in body and spirit. When he had donned his robe of white, Tenone led him back to the garden. They approached the tent. The Lord Saladin will now address you, Uncle Pietro said. Abraham came forward and put a hand on Sigismundo's shoulder, looking deeply into his eyes.
During this initiation, which is only a first initiation, he said, you have been exposed to many terrors and discomforts. You were alone. You were completely helpless to defend yourself if we had been inclined to malice or evil. Remember this every day of your life, I pray you. Hold it in your heart whenever you encounter any human being in nakedness, rags, poverty, danger, illness. For the widow's son, whose death you have partially relived, whose rebirth you have partially understood, remember when you were alone and frightened and helpless. Give freely, as we give freely to you. You are now a true brother and a free man. You will become more, more than you can imagine. Now whence comes all light? From the sun, Sigismundo ventured. What is the center around which all planets revolve? The sun. You speak with understanding, Abraham said, but such understanding comes only from reason and imagination. To the unaided eye, the earth seems to be the center. Men learned the truth only slowly, and some men who understood the truth before others were ready for it were killed or persecuted. Know, dare, will, and keep silence. Think about that many days. I must tell you that you have not found the center of yourself yet. You have, if you were lucky, seen a few rays of the light this evening. The truth of the mind is no more visible to ordinary sense than the truth of astronomy. The self that you know is like the earth. It only seems to be the center. The inner light, which you may have seen somewhat in the ceremony, is the true center, as the sun is the true center in astronomy. To find the inner sun, or fourth soul, or holy grail, is the aim of speculative masonry. Beyond that, there are further secrets of power, which you may someday attain if you persevere and reach the inner order of the sanctuary of the Gnosis, FRC. Look at these tools, Abraham said abruptly, producing a compass and a triangle from his robes. By using these instruments, we have already learned many secrets of the universe. By using them properly, you may learn some of the secrets of the inner universe. Take them, keep them, contemplate them. Now kneel, Abraham said. You have been raised, and now you must be accepted. Sigismundo knelt. Take him out, Abraham screamed. He is not ready to be one of us. Uncle Pietro led Sigismundo back to the living room again. You don't kneel, Uncle Pietro said impatiently. You answer, a Freemason kneels to no man. Damn it, I thought you were ready to understand. The humiliation was deliberate, to ensure that Sigismundo would remember. He understood that, but he was still mortified. They returned to the garden. Now kneel, Abraham said. A Freemason kneels to no man, Sigismundo recited. Abraham took his hand and arranged their fingers into the grip, thumbnails interlocking. This is the sign of true brotherhood, he said, staring into Sigismundo's eyes passionately. You are now an accepted Mason. Sigismundo was led around the garden again, sharing the grip with everybody. It is in my heart to tell you the legend of that grip, Abraham said. I do not assert that this legend is true, but that it has long been believed by the wisest of our order. All men who have joined hands that way, it is said, are true brothers. For if one man anywhere in the chain deals unfairly or treacherously with any other man anywhere in the chain, then all the men in the chain will surely die that day. I say not that this legend is true, but ponder it. If this trust be broken, we are not free men and true brothers, but mere beasts again only. Abraham stepped back. This session of the Temple of the East is now closed, Uncle Pietro shouted. Somebody pounded on the stones 3 times, then 5 times, then 3 times. Everybody began informally filing into the living room. Now we have a meal, Uncle Pietro said, unbending and becoming himself again. A banquet table had been set. There was a white tablecloth with a gold trim. The wall behind it bore a white tapestry with a gold design of an eye in a triangle. Abraham took the head of the table. Why is it necessary to eat? He asked ritualistically.
To replenish our bodies, Tononi said.
To what end?
To carry on the great work, Tononi replied.
There was no more ritual after that. Malatesta and Celine Muscatel was served, with an antipasto of cheeses and cold meats and peppers.
As soon as Sigismundo got home, he carefully found the family Bible in the hall and took it to his room. He checked every reference the Masons had given him. They were all there. The Masons had not printed up a special edition with their own heresies inserted. The Bible was simply a book he had never understood before. He took out the compass and triangle and looked at them. Dimly, all the pieces began to fit together, and he understood part of what it means to be a Freemason. From Sir John Babcock's Journal. Back in Paris again and still terribly depressed about Father's death. Thank God that I could be with him at his last moments. Strange how his final words haunt me. The same bleeding nonsense all over again. I can't imagine what he meant, but at the time I had a most eerie feeling, as if the reincarnation idea were true after all and Father was looking straight at his next life. It would be like him to decide it was the same bleeding nonsense. He knew. I know he knew. When he asked where Peter Hammersmith and I had been after Heidelberg, and I said, the Greek Isles, he nodded and looked at me most peculiarly. Yet, before God, I believe there was no contempt in that expression. It was just curiosity, wonderment. I think he suspected for years. A man who travels as much as I do and never marries eventually arouses that suspicion in those who know the ways of the world. When I remember my anxieties 9 years ago at Eton, I am almost amused. Now I know the rules. I know exactly what will happen if I am ever discovered. Certain doors to certain positions of power will close forever. Certain men will never invite me to their homes again. But that will be all. Our class does have a sense of union, and the lower orders are not allowed to hear about such things when one of us is involved. Still, now that I am Sir John Babcock, every door is open, if I evade discovery. And that is not difficult if one is careful. Sir John Babcock, every time I sign a check or a letter, I feel guilty. It is as if I were responsible for Father's death. I wish I could drop the damned sir entirely, but of course that would be too much of an eccentricity for the career I have in mind, if I ever recover from this depression. I will go to the Maison Noire tonight. They are said to have several new boys fresh from the country. That will cheer me up, even if I still hear that dying voice saying, the same bleeding nonsense all over again. It is just not my platonic proclivities. All men face this abyss once a year or more. Loneliness is the tax we pay to nature for being conscious enough to know our own mortality. From Sigismundo Cellini's Journal. 1 year ago, in 1768, shortly after I became an accepted Mason, there were massive arrests of Rossi in Roma, and then a few months later, in Napoli and Palermo, I heard some true tales of horror about how these fanatics reacted to inquisitorial interrogation. One actually bit his tongue in two when he was on the point of confessing. Other tales were even worse. Over 600 men were executed or sent to the galleys when it was all over. I dared to hope that the power of the Rossi was broken. I should have known better. There was no violet-eyed Balsamo among those arrested. Then, a few months ago, in the spring, a rich lady in Torino was robbed of jewels worth 500,000 florins at least. Somehow the notorious Verita, a publication that comes out of Parma once a month and is always in danger of being suppressed, got the inside details of the story. It seems that the thief did not break into the house but was invited in. He was, in fact, the lady's lover. He had spent 6 days with her while her husband was away on business, and then snatched the jewels one night while she was sleeping. The power is with me more often these days. I had an immediate premonition when I read that. Sure enough, today the Napoli police posted pictures of the suspect. There are probably similar drawings hanging on walls all over Italy. And even though it is a pen-and-ink sketch and the violet eyes look black,
There is no mistaking that face. I remember those eyes peering at me through a black hood when he said, "Brother, you were born under stars that make you one of us." I suspect that he will go to France, where the best fences are. Even if he realizes only a quarter of a million florins on the jewels, he will be rich enough to pass himself off as a count, if that be his pleasure. Whatever he does, I have a conviction that we will meet again. He resembles our father more than I do. He has learned from the Strege as well as the Rossi. He will be formidable. I have learned a great deal from old Abraham and from the club. I will be formidable too. I damned well better be.
When Maria Maldonado returned to Napoli in the summer of 1769, she found that an Englishman named Sir John Babcock was staying as a guest of her father's. It had something to do with business, she was told. Babcock was a cousin of the Greystokes, who were almost as important in England as the Maldonados were in southern Italy. She very quickly surmised that more than commerce was afoot. Maria, at 18 and a half, realized that most girls her age had been married off already. Papa had delayed so long, she knew, only because he approved of the kind of education she was receiving from Mother Ursula. Papa had said once that a stupid wife was the worst misfortune that could befall a man, and that a society that expected women to be ignorant was not in all respects rational itself. So Sir John Babcock was the first candidate being presented to her. There was no great pressure, and nothing overt was said. Papa was not that old-fashioned, but she understood. If Sir John were to be rejected clearly by her, another candidate would be around very soon. Her time had come. Sir John seemed to be about 25 or so, maybe a bit younger than that, and was quite handsome in an English way, once you got used to the fact that his skin always seemed pale and wan. But the English were all like that, and besides, Sir John had black hair and dark eyes, so he didn't seem as extremely pallid as all those blonde Englishmen she had seen around Capo di Monte. He was tall by Italian standards, almost 5 feet 9 inches, and he spoke Italian perfectly. The courtship began in the ritual form. Everybody left the living room one evening, almost on cue, except Aunt Bianca. Sir John and Maria were alone, more or less, as much alone as was considered decent. Sir John did not fidget or look uncomfortable, thank the Lord. He asked what she had studied in school. Maria described the curriculum Mother Ursula had devised for her girls. Sir John was impressed. "Conic sections," he repeated. "A most progressive woman, this abbess of yours." Maria asked about his studies. "I've been at Oxford and Heidelberg," he said casually, "and wandered here and there, studying a bit of this and a bit of that. Political history, mostly." "Political history?" Maria asked. Then she said boldly, "I always find that depressing." Sir John looked at her with interest. "It is depressing on the surface," he said, "but if you looked deeper, you might actually find it inspirational. It is not just wars and treacheries and great atrocities, you know. It is also the story of mankind's collective search for justice, a blind search full of frustrations and tragedies, but a search that always starts over again after every seeming defeat." Maria, having been bold for a girl, decided to be bolder. If Sir John could not stand an intelligent woman, so much the worse for him. "That search may never come to an end within history," she said. "We may have to look outside history for true inspiration."
"Outside history?" Sir John asked.
"Do you mean outside time?"
"Perhaps.
Outside the world of ordinary experience, certainly." Aunt Bianca frowned. This was no way to attract a man. Sir John, for all his seeming self-assurance, seemed to think the frown was directed at him. He looked about vaguely, and his glance lighted upon the clavicembalo.
"Do you play?" he asked politely.
"A bit," Maria answered. This was more ritual. Any educated girl was expected to play a musical instrument. "I would be most delighted," Sir John said, "if you could, favor me with a sample of your art." Maria moved to the instrument and seated herself, erect, not slouching, just as she had been taught. "I hope you will like this," she said, continuing the ritual by lowering her eyes modestly. She played Vivaldi's Winter Winds theme from the Four Seasons. Sir John leaned forward, listening intently. "My word," he said when she finished. "That was exceptionally well played. My compliments, Signorina Maldonado. Do you think that music came from beyond history and ordinary perception, perchance?"
"Yes," Maria said. "Where else?"
"And yet it was manifested within history and ordinary perception," Sir John said with a chess player's smile. "Cannot other things from higher realms also be manifested here, then? Even in politics?"
"Touché," Maria laughed.
He talked a while then, describing how Napoli seemed to him a place of extraordinary beauty, full of noise and bustle and excitement, but always a bit mysterious and incomprehensible. "England would seem like that to you, of course," he concluded, "if you ever came there, that is."
"The first hint."
Aunt Bianca coughed. "Would you be so good as to show me about the garden?" Sir John asked.
"I would be delighted," Maria replied.
They walked among the flowers beneath a full moon, with Aunt Bianca exactly 10 steps behind, so she could watch, but they could pretend or hope that she did not also hear.
"What music do you like best?" Sir John asked.
"The German Wunderkind, Wolfgang Amadeo Mozart."
"Ah," Sir John said, "my own favorite.
He has changed his middle name to Amadeus lately, for some reason I fail to comprehend. I had thought the fad of Latinizing one's name went out 2 centuries ago. But isn't it incredible what he has written? He is only 14.
"I am only 18, sir."
"Yes, I didn't mean..."
Maria laughed. "I was teasing."
Sir John smiled. "You are doing very well," he said softly. "I appreciate that this whole situation is a bit awkward for you. Your father has told me you have never been courted before."
"Ah," he admitted he was courting.
"You are doing well yourself," Maria said.
"Listen," Sir John said. "Suppose we both jump dear old Aunt Bianca and stuff her in the potting shed or some convenient place. Then we could be alone and decide what we really think of each other."
"Most marvelous," Maria said. "Then my reputation would be ruined in the morning, and you would have to marry me, or else one of my brothers would have the melancholy duty of shooting you dead. Carlo is the best pistol shot in Napoli, I must warn you."
"Splendid," Sir John said. "It sounds like a most adventurous opportunity."
"It would be exciting to wake in the morning knowing that I must choose between death and marriage."
"Are all Englishmen as mad as you?"
"Only a few. But it is the national tradition to be at least eccentric. My father was a most righteous and dignified personage. A judge, in fact. Yet he was seldom sober after twilight."
They walked in silence for a few moments.
"Seriously," Sir John said, "if it is agreeable to you, Signorina, I would enjoy seeing a great deal more of you, and if you can bear my presence for a few weeks, we can then discuss how much more of me you could find likable, and the obvious purpose of my attendance upon you."
"Yes," Maria said, "I would enjoy walking and talking with you on other occasions."
Aunt Bianca coughed again. Maria and Sir John had had as much private conversation as was considered proper at that stage. When Maria returned to her room, she was both excited and bewildered. She had observed men looking at her lustfully at times. She knew that she would marry eventually. There was the constant annoyance of the demented Celline fellow, staring at her like a saint seeing a vision of the Virgin. But all of that was suddenly much more real than before. She knew that the idea of being in love was exciting. The novels all said it was better than finding gold, better than flying to the stars like an angel. But it was not just novelistic romance that was making her feel this way. It was that special pleasure, the most secret of all pleasures, the pleasure that was so strictly forbidden and could get you into all sorts of trouble before you were married and was then, all at once, no longer forbidden, the very moment you were married. Some of the girls at the convent school had experimented with that pleasure, upon themselves or upon one another. But Maria had been afraid to attempt such experiments because of the power in her hands, the power to heal. She was worried that any sin could do something terrible to the power, turn it in a dark direction, send her hurtling toward the abyss of witchcraft. After all, there were only 2 types of people who had that power, the saints and the stregge. You could easily cross the line, become a saint or a stregge without even realizing you had gained or lost your soul itself. And yet, although the thought was sinful,
She could not stop thinking what it would be like to be married to Sir John and to have sexual intercourse with him. It was like a forest fire, she knew, and not just in novels. People in real life did all kinds of wild, crazy, even violent things once they had been initiated into that secret ecstasy. Some rich men had so many mistresses, despite the church's prohibitions, that it was obvious they lived chiefly for sexual pleasure. It was to them what God was to the saints. And there were even women, and not a few women either, who committed adultery, who had lovers because they had grown bored with their husbands or had never liked their husbands in the first place. Sometimes a whole town would know about such affairs before the husband himself learned. Sometimes murder would result, and then if the wife's family was the richer of the two, the husband would be hanged. Or if the husband's family was richer, the judges would decide that the evidence was inconclusive, and they would set him free. There were always a few known murderers like that in Napoli and in other cities. Sometimes such a man would die mysteriously, and there would be rumors of the wife's family having taken revenge with unknown and undetectable poisons, such as the Borgias had supposedly used. There was nothing else in the world except money that caused so many violent passions. That was why the church said it was an occasion of sin to even think about it. And yet, when you were married, it was not a sin anymore. What would sexual intercourse be like with an Englishman? With Sir John specifically? Everybody said Italians made the best lovers, but nobody anywhere in history or in legend had ever said they made the best husbands. If she married Sir John, if that seemed like the wise choice, she would always be faithful to him. That was virtue, and besides, Maria detested sneaking and lying. But it would be strange to have grown up in Italy and never to have sexual intercourse with anyone but an Englishman. One thing was certain. Sir John was not an ordinary man. When he spoke of justice as something that kept trying to manifest itself within history, he was speaking of his deepest beliefs. You could tell that from his tone. The heroes of novels always had high ideals like that, and they were sensitive and a bit secretive about some guilty secret hidden in their past. But the guilt was not really something terrible, and the heroines always loved them in spite of it. Maria wondered if Sir John had some guilty secret. A man who spoke so passionately of justice had probably experienced injustice. Well, anyway, she decided, he's not as absurd as that clownish Cellini fellow. But when Maria finally went to sleep that night, she had a dream in which a man was having sexual intercourse with her, and it didn't hurt at all, even though it was the first time. He was very delicate, and it was quite lovely, almost like the nun singing Ave Maria at Mass. And then she saw that the man was that horrible Sigismundo Cellini, and she woke up, knowing that it was more than a dream, that it had happened to her in her sleep. 2 nights later, Papa took Maria and Sir John to the Teatro San Carlo to hear a new performance by our most controversial local musician, as he said. Maria did not want to go to a performance by that mad Cellini, ick, but she could not think of any excuse to get out of it. One couldn't tell one's father about something as silly as the yearning stare in which Cellini haunted her days, or something as intimate as the fact that Cellini had now invaded her nights and intercoursed her in her sleep. Sir John was most curious when Count Maldonado told him about the mixed reception Cellini's music had received thus far. Frankly, Sir John was all for innovation and eccentricity in art. Most of it was trash, of course, but it was a challenge to the audience, because great works always seemed intentionally irritating at first before people got accustomed to them. The concert began conservatively enough. Sigismundo Cellini, who looked as if he might still be a year or so shy of 20, played pieces by Vivaldi, Scarlatti, and somebody named J.S. Bach. He played well, except for a tendency towards overemphasis, as if he was forcing more emotion than was appropriate to the music. At the intermission, nobody was either greatly disturbed or greatly impressed. The main question discussed was whether this J.S. Bach was a brother or a cousin of the famous J.C. and C.P.E. Bach. When the audience returned, Sigismundo announced a new composition by himself, which he called Sonata 23, Fire and Water. As Sigismundo began, nobody in the theater had any doubt that the opening bars were the fire theme. Sir John recognized that the structure, a permutation of triplets, seemed to be going forward and backward at the same time.
Then he realized there were actually two structures involved, that the fire was itself a conflict of inner tensions, as if a man might feel himself drawn to the divine and the diabolical with equal force in both directions. So that in the music, as in such a man, combustion was a symptom of explosion, of some inner fission or earthquake of the soul. This was hardly music, it was Job's complaint. Judging from a few murmurs elsewhere in the audience, some people thought it was not beyond music but beneath music, some species of barbarism or deliberate insult. But the second movement, arriving so abruptly that the laws of harmonic development seemed to have been stupidly or brutally violated, was a series of arpeggi so tranquil, so humorous, so limpid, that it was not just an answer in the traditional argument structure of the sonata, but a leap to another level of discourse. This watery progression did not deny the fire, but merely reflected it, and, Sir John thought absorbed, it reflected like light itself, like one of the incandescent thrones of Dante's Paradiso. Then, somehow, Cellini had found his way from the celestial or brilliant opening to something that was suspiciously like Neapolitan bel canto, which seemed, Sir John realized, as if it might be one of the two-in-one fire themes permuted in conscious self-mockery. But the resolution, the last part of the second movement, was a structure of both fire and water, passionate staccati and languid legati, as if Cellini were trying to leap beyond the limits of both music and logic, affirming and bitterly grieving at once. Somebody laughed rudely, and a voice said, "He's willfully being annoying." "Ranting and raving," another voice said. Sir John, however, was remembering his first initiation at the Scotch Rite Temple in London. Fire and water are one. This composition was not merely a joke at the expense of musical decorum, but a very private in-joke for fellow masons. It was like writing a book that only one reader in 1,000 could understand. The third movement did not combine fire and water, that possible denouement having arrived unexpectedly as the climax of the second movement, but consisted of variations on water, repeating all the watery themes in new ways that seemed extraordinary. There were gasps of delight in several parts of the audience. This movement at least was winning over many. But then Sir John noticed that each variation was progressively a little more pathetic than the last, until a definitely dirge-like quality had come into a theme that seemed at first as wild as a tarantella. The water was becoming a watery grave. The mood plunged down, down, further down to melancholy and doom. Sir John thought of poor Geoffrey, years ago at Eton, but he also recognized several parodies of Death Audie from popular operas in there. But then, by some miracle of logic turned on its head, the most melancholy bar of this pathetic theme repeated itself and then repeated again with only a slight variation, and then it was back again with a seemingly equally slight variation, except now it was part of the fire theme that had been hidden in the water theme all along. A masterpiece of disguise, Sir John thought. This was very humorous music indeed, ridiculing itself every step of the way, and yet it also sadly confessed all the emotions it parodied. And now, as the melancholy death by water and the ecstatically bizarre death by fire joined in the climax that was both necessary and absurdly unexpected, they became united in a triumphant and definitely drunken-sounding caper, often to various traditional forms of resolution until, logically but incredibly, arriving at the opening theme played once and hanging there. A conclusion that was not recognized as such by most of the audience for nearly 10 seconds before the wild applause and the angry boos began. Sigismundo Cellini bowed somewhat sardonically. "He is determined," Sir John thought, "to accept the boos as well as the applause, as homages to his originality, or else he has steeled himself to such a reception and is putting on a damned good mask of indifference." Sigismundo returned to the harpsichord. "Now," he announced, "to finish the evening, I will play something less conservative." Cheeky bastard, Sir John thought. "This is my Sonata 56, which I call also the Two Nations." Such clashing and crashing about had never been heard before in the Teatro San Carlo, and would not be heard again for 50 years. "He thinks the clavicembalo is a percussion instrument," somebody muttered angrily near Sir John.
But out of this cacophony, a theme surprisingly emerged. It had been implicit all along, hidden among the howling discords. It was a waltz theme, suitable for a state ball in any palace in Europe. Sir John could almost see exquisitely gowned ladies and periwigged gentlemen dancing to this sensuous legato. Then the roaring and clashing began to return. It was like a mob of peasants storming the palace. No, as Sir John listened, it seemed more like goblins and clowns. The waltz struggled onward, seeking to reassert itself, but each sensual gallant upsurge led, by perverse artistry, back into one of the weird, angry sounds of the invasion. It was no longer quite clear to Sir John whether the invaders were revolutionaries, as he had imagined at first, or mischievous wood sprites, as it later seemed, or some barbaric tribe from the outskirts of civilization, reanimated Vikings gone berserk. The structure of this musical conflict, Sir John realized, was densely packed. It made each minute seem longer and larger than a mere orthodox structure would. A feeling of giganticism began to emerge, a sense of cyclopean or titanic figures, not threatening the waltzers, but merely towering above them, indifferent, moving on some mission of their own that mortals could not understand. But the waltz itself was being magnified in the course of this musical argument. The waltzers were not merely people, they themselves were growing to the stature of gods. Was it mere repetition, a redundance, that a more polished or more traditional composer would have avoided as clumsy, or was it some subtle variation that the ordinary ear could not catch? Somehow, by whatever means, Cellini was turning the innocent dance theme into a force stronger than the threatening invasion theme. And out of this, a sunny Neapolitan song gradually revealed itself. It was, in fact, the invasion theme with the bombast and heroism removed. Cellini was revealing that all that had been heard was a set of variations implicit in the real theme, and it was a theme that all ears could recognize as normal and quite lovely. Except that now, with these inner tensions having been explored, this ordinary Neapolitan melody sounded like an evasion or an apology. The conclusion was not a concession to contemporary taste, but a mocking joke at the expense of such taste. It ended with trills so lovely that only those who had listened very closely could realize they were hearing melodic satire. The applause this time was louder and more passionate. So were the boos and catcalls. Sigismundo bowed again with great dignity and left the stage with a haughty and arrogant stride, as if he had not heard the boos. The effect was slightly spoiled when his eye caught Maria in the Maldonado box, and he fell over his feet, landing on his backside. Returning home, Count Maldonado discreetly acquired a companion, an old man named Pietro Malatesta, uncle of the Cellini fellow, and the two of them dropped back several paces. Maria and Sir John were being allowed their second interlude of comparative privacy. "I think this evening was most provocative," Sir John ventured. "When he grows a bit and loses the desire to be merely astonishing, this Cellini will have quite a future, I would say." "He will be another Casanova, I think," Maria said, with an emotion Sir John did not understand at first. "With such a character, he will abandon music eventually to become a mere adventurer." "I hope not," Sir John said thoughtfully. "I found it all more entertaining than annoying myself, as if he had taken us into his workshop and shown the struggle out of which the music emerged. Most extraordinary." "He is an obsessed fellow," Maria said angrily. "He once almost killed my brother Carlo in a silly quarrel. There is more fire than water in him." "Well, as for that," Sir John said, "I wouldn't know. I am commenting only on his music." "He is a madcap, a harlequin." "Perhaps," Sir John said. "He should come to England. Nobody would notice him there, since we are all mad, as you have noticed." Maria smiled finally. "You are droll." "And you do not really dislike this Cellini," Sir John said calmly. "I think you are attracted to him and do not know why. That is what makes you angry." "Do not talk like that in Napoli," Maria whispered urgently. "People will think you are a witch." "Ah," he said, "you are beginning to worry about my welfare. That is a promising sign." But later Maria realized that she had not denied what he said about her attraction to that obsessed Cellini. And she knew that in some sense he was almost correct. She still remembered the dream,
which was more than a dream, in which Cellini had taken her psychological, if not physical, virginity.